Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS, Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And Chris, today, a real honor to have with us Bill Demski. Bill is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He has authored or edited numerous books, including the first book on intelligent design to be published by a major university press, The Design Inference, Eliminating Chance Through Small Probabilities. He has 7 earned degrees, including a PhD in philosophy, PhD in mathematics, and currently lectures around the globe on the topic of intelligent design. Along with Jonathan Wells, he has co-authored a book that we're really looking forward to discussing today. It's called The Design of Life, Discovering Signs of Intelligence in Biological Systems. Bill, good morning. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be with you.
Dr. Demski, you're a mathematician and a philosopher, not necessarily a biologist. How is it that you came to be involved with this whole discussion on intelligent design?
That's a good question. I think what I bring to the party, as it were, is some analytic tools to analyze just what the biologists are doing. You know, so I think it's not so crucial just at times just what all the details of the biology are, but how they're marshaling evidence, whether the conclusions that they're drawing actually follow from the evidence that they're presenting. And what I found over the years was that there was a real disconnect between some very strong hypotheses about how life arose and got more complex and diversified, and what the actual evidence was for it. I think just to say a little bit about my math background, my specialty is probability theory and probability and statistics. And so a big question there is, what's within the reach of chance, what's outside the reach of chance?
Mm-hmm.
The sorts of mechanisms proposed by the evolutionists are chance-based mechanisms. The dominant theory of evolution is the neo-Darwinian one, which sees the raw material for biological innovation in random genetic errors. And then that is harnessed by natural selection, and that over time is supposed to lead from a single cell to you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's is that process, is it adequate to accomplish all the evolutionary work that's ascribed to it? And my methods of design detection and analytic tools that I've developed suggest to me that that's not, in fact, the case.
It's very surprising to me that when we talk about evolution, and in particular that importance of defining it as a Darwinistic or the Darwinist version of evolution, that again, that random selection, that these things happen by chance, that when you talk to scientists about this, that if you even begin to infer that there is an intelligence behind this evolution or these occurrences, that all of a sudden that scientific door that's supposed to be open to all possibilities slams shut. And all of a sudden, at the very base of it, you know, name calling occurs and all kinds of things. I mean, help me to understand this, Bill, how in this area of science, there seems to be only one mode that is acceptable in today's culture.
Well, I think, perhaps worse than that. I mean, scientific societies, I'm told that over 100 scientific organizations have now formally denounced intelligent design. And it's really quite a reversal when you think of Darwin. You can't read The Origin of Species but to see that design is the foil against which he's arguing. I mean, it's design versus his view of natural selection. They're pitted against each other, and his whole approach is to say, well, my view, my hypothesis, explains the data better than a design hypothesis. And so we're coming back now and saying, with the revolutions in molecular biology and the information sciences, that in fact intelligent design needs to be back on the table, and it's just prescribed, it's just ruled out of court. Now, why is that? I mean, I think there's a history of scientific revolutions. Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and I think we see some of that happening with the intelligent design debate, in the sense that you have a new idea that comes along, promises to supplant the old idea and the old guard, digs in its heels and doesn't want this new idea to prosper. But I think there's even more going on there. And I think we're dealing with an atheistic worldview that's very closely tied to evolutionary theory. A historian of biology, Will Provine at Cornell University, has said that Darwinism is the greatest engine for atheism ever devised.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some truth there, because this is when you look at the process that Darwin proposed, it is a strictly materialistic process. There's really no place for teleology or design to come in. At best, you can say, if you're going to try to retain some sort of theism, is to say that God set up this process to bring about biological complexity, to bring us about. But the thing is, when you actually look in the process itself, there's nothing there that suggests a deity or any sort of design, you know. So it's really just a pure faith move at that point to say, well, God did it, because the whole point of evolutionary theory, as Darwin developed it, and there's even some recent evidence that he was very materialistic right from the start in his thinking about that the whole point was to say that no design was needed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's supposed to be the beauty of his theory, that you can get design, as it were, the appearance of design without any actual design. You'll have somebody like Richard Dawkins, who'll begin his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of being designed for a purpose. I mean, biologists admit that the appearance of design is there, but then they claim that there's this materialistic process that can do it all. And so in a sense, evolution has become a means of justifying a materialistic creation story. And so you have all these big worldview issues that come into play. And so you have, on the one hand, intelligent design, which is friendly towards theism in a way that evolutionary theory is not. And then you have evolutionary theory, which seems to underwrite an atheism, or at best a faith that's a believism, as it were. There's no evidence from the world that would point to any sort of intelligence behind it. And then, beyond that, I think you're getting into the very nature of science itself. Can science invoke intelligent causes? Is that legitimate
mm-hmm.
science? And science itself, historically, has differed on that. I mean, if you go back to Aristotle, Aristotelian science allowed some form of teleology, but with the rise of modern science, things got very mechanistic. And so that's also being negotiated in this whole debate. So it's a debate in which just about every big question gets touched on.
Yeah, I am not a scientist, of course, but I think rather well. And as I'm thinking through the arguments, it almost seems as though for atheists, their dogma is Darwin. And that if you try to suggest anything else other than a Darwinistic approach to evolution or the evolving of how we became to be, that they slap it down as rigidly as they would accuse those who have a faith type of basis for their understanding.
Well, I think that's right. I think there really aren't too many options in this origins debate. Al Planning, a very well-known philosopher of religion, commenting on it, said, if you're a materialist, then this Darwinian view is really the only game in town. You need a designer substitute, and the only designer substitute that the materialists have been able to find is natural selection. Because, I mean, you look at biological systems, and they clearly look designed. So that's, I think, really the only option you have if you're going to go the materialistic route. And I think there's this sense, this deep-seated sense in the scientific community that if you open the door to intelligent design, you're going to go back to superstition. You're going to explain things, but with the God of the gaps. Why, if you don't understand something, you're just going to say, "Well, God did it." End of story. And that's not what intelligent design is about. And in fact, this may be a good place to give a definition of intelligent design.
Please,
and I would define it as follows: it's the study of patterns in nature that are best explained as the product of intelligence. And so what we're doing is we're looking at various patterns in nature, and we're saying, is this a type of pattern that we should properly ascribe to intelligence as opposed to material forces? And we draw this sort of distinction all the time. When you look at Mount Rushmore, you know, nobody driving through southwest South Dakota is going to think that wind and erosion did that,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, so it's clear that that's beyond the reach of material forces. We ask these questions in other contexts, archaeology. We ask it in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Is that radio signal coming to us from outer space, is it the result of an intelligence, or is it just random radio noise? Problem is, when we take those same methods of design detection, look at the sorts of patterns that would in other contexts tell us that we're dealing with intelligence, apply them to biology, the question then immediately arises, well, who or what would that intelligence be? And unlike the SETI case, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where an alien intelligence, a materialistic scientist could say, well, that alien intelligence evolved by Darwinian processes, if design, intelligent design, is actually involved in the formation of life on Earth, then that would have to be an unevolved intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And that very quickly pushes you in the direction of theism. And if you're a materialist, you don't want to go there.
Right.
So there's this move to shut the discussion down, to just call this religion. And yes, intelligent design has theological implications, but likewise, Darwinism has theological implications or anti-theological implications. I mean, when you have somebody like the late Stephen Jay Gould, who writes a book, Ever Since Darwin, and in that book writes, Ever Since Darwin, we know that we were not created in the image of a benevolent God.
Hmm.
I mean, that's a huge implication that he's drawing from Darwinian theory, and it's a theological implication.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be able to get around the theological implications of these origin theories. But the crucial question, though, from a scientific advantage, is are these theories, do they stand on their own feet? Can they be developed as that scientific theories, regardless of what their implications are? Scientific theories have implications, theological, metaphysical, philosophical, fine. But can they be developed on their own terms? And if they can, and that's what we're suggesting about intelligent design, then they should be considered science and not just slapped with the label religion, fundamentalism, creationism, or whatever, because people don't like what the implications are.
Right.
And I think it's very important, given what we have come to understand or have found out that we understand less than we thought we did when it comes to the study of mathematics or of physics or that the origins of just the universe and how gravity and all those different things, we're learning that those were laws that were absolutes for so many generations. And even now we've come to understand that there's nothing absolute about those things, that there's a depth and an understanding and a reason that there doesn't seem to be any type of randomness.
Well, and you know, I think most scientists would agree that scientific theorizing needs to be tentative, that the new evidence can always arise and overturn or modify our scientific theory. But in this debate, it seems that that admission and this idea that science is self-correcting and that it needs to be in contact with the evidence, that doesn't seem to be allowed. It's as though this is the final science. This is inviolable science. It's become a dogma. And I think that's actually very destructive to science and scientific inquiry when you have that sort of attitude that comes out.
Well, I think that's what you do so well in The Design of Life, because you go back and you even take a look at how did Darwin come to some of his conclusions, and even how in some of his conclusions, the evidence that he was using was severely flawed. I mean, I think the most classic is the embryology chart that he was using that had us all looking exactly the same at a certain stage. And that's what he saw, and it turned out that whole chart was horribly flawed.
Well, it was. You're actually referring to a disciple of Darwin, Ernst Haeckel, and I mean, it wasn't just that it was flawed; it was faked. I mean, he actually knew better, and he still drew these embryos so that they were very similar when they weren't, and he did that because he thought the theory demanded it.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, a problem: shoehorning the data into preconception.
Mm-hmm.
And that unfortunately happens. I think it happens very much in this debate. You know, but I think the idea that Darwin's ideas, this is a 19th century idea in some ways. I mean, it plays off of certain economic ideas at the time, and I think it really doesn't doesn't work with the new evidence that we have in the 20th and 21st centuries. I mean, Darwin, when he looked at the cell, he saw it as this little blob of jello enclosed by a membrane. It was very simple. He could explain it by spontaneous generation. Mud left to itself over time could, sure, it could just produce a cell. Now we look inside the cell, and we see a marvel of engineering. In fact, our very best engineering technologies, we see them mirrored in the cell and exceeded in the cell. And so our best metaphor for the cell these days is not a blob of jello enclosed by membrane, but an automated city in which everything is automated. And we find the things we find in the cell are information storage, retrieval, processing, signal transduction circuitry, digital data embedding technologies, data embedded within data, transportation devices, zip codes, as it were, because things have to be targeted for various places in the cell. So you put a little tag on it, and then it gets delivered to the right location. All of that is going on inside the cell. And so the question I often like to pose is if we need to be engineers to understand what's going on inside the cell. If the cell reflects our very best technologies, is it such a stretch to think that the cell is actually designed and not just merely an appearance of design?
And you point out, too, tell me if I'm correct in this, that he did not have access to the work of Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk who did so much in the field in his time on genetics.
Well, that's right. In fact, it's been found that Darwin's library, there was a copy of Mendel's article, but it had never been opened up. But the thing is, I mean, Mendel's ideas about genes and how they get transferred from one generation to the other, Darwin's ideas of heredity were completely different. It was not that genes occurred in these discrete units. It was all kind of a blending heredity that he had, which really completely undercut his theory. I mean, his notion of heredity would not even have allowed natural selection to accomplish anything. So in a sense, Mendel was actually taken by Darwinists to revive Darwin. And so what's called neo-Darwinism, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, is actually a combination of Darwinism with Mendel. And so Mendel has been used to assist with Darwin, and then Mendel had to be certainly revised with when the structure of DNA was found in the 1950s. He was going with very limited knowledge, but I would say that the Darwinists have been very adept at co-opting whatever they can to help support their theory. I don't think Mendel really does the job for them, but they've used it.
And I think you outline not only biologically but societally how the effect of Darwinism can affect us all in a way. And I think in so many ways that the Darwinistic approach to evolution falls apart, whether it's the fossil record that can't be determined or even just the fact that we have altruism in the human species, which is where someone will run into a building to try to save someone else at their own life's peril, when that totally violates that whole process of the survival of the fittest.
Well, I think that's right, but I think one thing to be aware of is that Darwinists are never at a loss for words, so they have explanations of altruism. I mean, E.O. Wilson has expended some ink to explain why Mother Teresa is perhaps an evolutionary freak, or why really she did have certain ulterior motives for being so good, namely the rewards awaiting her in heaven. You know, I mean, so there's always this sense, this move to explain things away that would otherwise challenge the theory. Likewise with the fossil record. I think that the fossil record is a horrendous indictment of Darwinian theory. I mean, Darwin, the only figure in Darwin's Origin of Species, which appeared in the sixth edition of the Origin of Species, is a tree-like diagram, which is this great metaphor of Darwin, the tree of life, where you have at the base of the tree this root, single organism, and everything else branches out from that. But you look at the fossil record, and it doesn't seem to conform to that pattern at all. And yet, saying that, we haven't searched the fossil record enough, or fossilization happens where we never really see it, or rather, or rather when fossilization happens, it happens at these discrete distances. I mean, there are all sorts of moves that are made to explain why the fossil record doesn't conform to it and why the theory should still be held on to. I would say to a dispassionate outsider, you look at that and you say, well, this is a lot of special pleading. They're just going through contortions, trying to make the theory fit the data. But to those on the inside, they just keep chugging along merrily. And then they have all these methods of control. I mean, I sometimes compared how the Darwinists keep their theory afloat to a Stalinist regime, because they really go after people who start challenging the theory. And research funds denied, tenure denied, faculty denied. Right. I mean, all of this. I've experienced some of this myself. You know? So it's there's very much, I think, a thought control, thought police that works to keep this as the only theory to explain biological complexity and diversity.
And I think that's the real shame, if not the crime of it all, is that here we are supposed to have this great advance of science and seeking out, even for those of us who have a proclivity to have a belief in God, that through that divine accommodation we can come and to know him by using our reason to seek him out, to study, that those doors would be slammed shut. That you're not even allowed to talk about it without being penalized. And Bill, I grew up in the 60s, and of course I saw Inherit the Wind. I still remember Spencer Tracy and portraying the Clarence Darrow character, in essence, as the person of thought, and then William Jennings Bryan as this poor, misguided biblical fool, and how you would not want to be a Bryan. That you would want to grow up to be a Darrow, but yet
I mean it's the morality tale. And you want, if you're at all a reasonable, clear-thinking person, you'd want to be on the side of the evolutionist if you look at that movie. By the way, we do a nice take on that movie and the whole stereotype that's developed from that in the epilogue of The Design of Life.
That's right.
It's called the Inherit the Wind stereotype. And, that has been enormously influential and helpful in propping up Darwinian theory in the popular mind.
One thing I never realized, though, Bill, was the fact that Bryan made a deal with Darrow in the actual case to cross-examine him on Darrow's belief in evolution, and he never got the opportunity because immediately after his examination by Darrow, Darrow pleaded guilty and effectively stopped it so that William Jennings Bryan could not cross-examine him.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit more subtle. I mean, he directed the judge to find his client guilty, but it was it wasn't a direct guilty plea, because they wanted to keep this open for in the appeals process. So it was kind of a technical legal move, but it closed the evidence and thus denied Bryan the opportunity to cross-examine Darrow on his views on evolution. You know, so that's right. I think to this day, evolutionists, we've never really had them on the witness stand in a way where we've really been able to effectively cross-examine them.
Yeah, it continues today, doesn't it?
The Dover case that was about 2-3 years ago, but even there, the attorneys who were supporting the Dover board, I think, were really undermanned and didn't really do their homework.
Well, I loved it. I mean, The Design of Life is going to be one of those books. Of course, I feel like I'm a student of life, and reading The Design of Life, it has just opened my eyes in so many ways. I just think that the average reader, as long as those who are seeking it a fuller and deeper understanding, could really benefit from your work.
Well, thank you so much. And if I may, I'd like to give a website where you can purchase it, because it's not as widely available as we'd like at this point. The marketing is just getting going on it. It's available at thedesignoflife.net. And that's really the most inexpensive place to purchase it. You'll probably get the best service. So www.thedesignoflife.net.
Well, we'll definitely have that up on our website, and don't be afraid to read it, and don't allow people to slam doors shut on our own investigations wherever we're being led in our understanding.
Been talking this morning with Dr. William Dembski, along with Dr. Jonathan Wells, have co-authored the book, The Design of Life, Discovering Signs of Intelligence in Biological Systems. And Bill, before we're done, any final thoughts or closing thoughts that you have? Maybe a little nugget we didn't touch on. Obviously, it's tough to do that in the constraints of the interview time that we have.
I think where I'd go with this is just to say that there's a huge worldview implications here. Are we the result of a blind, purposeless material process and all that that entails for our meaning or lack of meaning in the world? Or are we the result of a purposeful intelligence that brought us here to have a meaning and have a purpose? And I think that's what's really at stake in this debate. And intelligent design speaks to the scientific evidence for there being purpose behind the natural world.
Yeah, it is wonderful. I hope I'm quoting him properly, but essentially Pope Benedict XVI said there doesn't have to be this shut a door. I mean, this yeah. they go hand in hand.
No, I've enjoyed some of what the Pope has had to say on these issues. I think he speaks more generally about teleology rather than intelligent design as a scientific program, but I think he's got very good intuitions about this whole debate.
Well, to borrow words from the discussion, I'm glad the designer allowed us to have this conversation here today.
So. Very much. I've enjoyed my time with you.
All right, Bill, thanks so much. We appreciate it.